So I'm Josephine Ensign, and I'm here today with Jen Adams. Thanks, Jen, for finding parking and getting here.
No problem.
And it's Wednesday, January 11th, 2023, and we're at Jack Straw Studios. So, Jen, the first question I have for you, and just go where you want with this, but what led you to the work that you're doing? Like, what's your story of what got you here?
I experienced homelessness. And then I saw what was happening on the street, and I didn't see anybody else paying attention.
Okay. So when was that?
So I was on the street myself between 2007 and 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was still out there between 2013 and 2014 with no substance abuse. And no vehicle, just on the streets. I had a car accident where I was hit by a car, and I shattered my pelvis in two places. He had no insurance. I, of course, had no insurance on my bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
I luckily found somebody at the hospital that came in with my insurance and said, "Hey, what can we do for you?" And I said, "Well, you know, a house would be nice." And they plucked me from Swedish hospital, and they took me to a facility in Bremerton where I spent 3 months healing. And then when I was let out, I went back to the street and then waited for housing. And in 2014, I became housed.
That's good. So, and did you ever live in your car or your
vehicle? Yeah, I lived in three different vans and a doorway.
Ah, okay.
So.
All right. And so can you tell me a little bit of what, I mean, obviously the accident was a big thing towards the end, but what kind of, like what?
Well, that was my third car accident being hit on my bicycle while I was unhoused.
Yeah.
It was the things that I saw and the people that I saw that weren't getting the help that they needed, especially mental illness and substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it in people, and I just started reaching out to people and, you know, bringing people water and telling them that they were worthy, and that's kind of how I started. And then every time there was a giveaway or something, I'd gather things for people that I knew couldn't make it there.
Mm-hmm.
So one Thanksgiving, I handed out like 12 sleeping bags on my bicycle.
And oh, goodness.
So I had to go get them every time,
right,
because I could only carry two or three at a time. That was fun, though, because it was exciting to me to be on a bicycle and riding in the wind and knowing I was helping somebody. So it gave me purpose. And as soon as I realized that I liked that, and that I could help people, I just couldn't stop, and I haven't stopped.
Right. So you're still probably not riding your bicycle in handing out.
Not as much.
Probably from
no.
your car. Now.
I might have a van now.
Right, yeah, that's good. Okay.
A van that was donated, by the way.
Oh, that's good.
Because of the work I do.
Yeah.
People just saw what I was doing and said, "Hey, we should help you out. Hey, let's give you this."
Oh, nice. That's good. And what area, I assume that was like in Seattle of when this was happening?
Yeah, or? So I parked and lived in the Ballard area,
mm-hmm,
when I was homeless, because there was a lot of services around that area at the time. And then I have to be by water no matter where I am in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so the water was there to keep me at peace and to kind of keep me calm so I could help other people. But I think the final straw to get me from just somebody trying to help other people to, oh my gosh, I really need to do something, was the amount of people I saw die on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still involved with Women in Black now. But that's probably the most horrific part of what I saw was good people dying,
mm-hmm,
for no reason other than they had given up hope.
Right. And I assume that that's both people that were living in their vehicles and people just living rough out on the streets.
Yes,
yeah,
definitely.
Right.
People in the vehicles have a little bit more of a ownership and pride in what they have, and that, you know, that they have something, and so they don't normally consider themselves homeless, maybe unhoused, but not necessarily homeless.
Homeless, right, yeah. I've heard that from a lot of different people. And it makes sense if you...
Because they have ownership.
Right. They own a place where they're living.
Right, and that's what America's about, right? Yeah. Ownership and, you know, the American dream, and that's part of it. You know, that we're getting farther and farther away from the ownership of housing, right, of owning a house. I bought a house in 1991 for $79,000 out the door. You can't probably use that as a down payment now.
No, can't even buy a little wood shack in the backyard somewhere. Yeah.
So, and then the last thing you own when you're losing everything you own is probably your vehicle. So that becomes your home.
Right. That makes sense. And probably a lot of single people, but also families that you were dealing with.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not specific.
Yeah.
It's everybody, race, creed, age, families, non-families. One of the first families I came across was a married couple that were nine months pregnant, living in a little Toyota Corolla.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking.
That child's eight now.
Yeah.
And lives in housing with their mother.
Good.
And the father's still kind of out there, but in a better place.
Right. Right. That's good. Yeah, I ran into a 79-year-old woman at Elizabeth Gregory this weekend, living in her car.
What a wonderful organization
that is. Yeah, they are. I love working there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it sounds like you, when you were homeless, you know, both in your vehicle and then also when you were living rough outside or in a doorway, like you said, of being aware of just like a lack of people helping out or being like different services, and that you got into kind of the self-help and also helping other people that way. But what other kinds of things do you remember, like people or organizations that were helpful? I mean, Women in Black, it sounds like you got involved with them. That's helpful.
So eventually I worked for Wheel and Share. But before that happened, I used to get I used to get hard-boiled eggs from this one, Helpers for the Homeless. So they would come around with little bags of food, and just that's where I got my hugs.
Nice. So it was food and hugs.
Yeah, food and hugs and hard-boiled eggs, because I like hard-boiled eggs. Yeah. So that was and I lived in my van, and usually they're like an ice box if they're not insulated well. And so I had one drawer where I could keep eggs for a couple days, and they'd still be good. So I was always happy to get that kind of that because of my MS. I need to eat closer to raw, so that was one of my favorite organizations. Heroes for the Homeless.
Oh, Heroes for the Homeless. Yes, I do know that.
They were one of the ones that I didn't mind if they knocked on my van. Anybody else, I would get really angry. Leave me alone. And then Reach. Reach was out there. Reach was everywhere. Reach was helping my friends. But I didn't need Reach. At least I didn't think so. But they definitely helped a lot of my rougher friends, really in addiction with harder drugs. I had an addiction, but it was alcohol, and it was more, I think I was just trying to drown. Went to treatment once, walked away. Next June will be 11 years. So
good for you.
It wasn't a big crutch. It was just I think I got in a rut.
Yeah.
Of depression, and homelessness can be really hard on the psyche. You have to be okay to be alone, and luckily I'm okay to be alone. So a lot of those things didn't challenge me, but they do for so many. We know after the pandemic how hard it is to be alone. And if you're alone and you're sick and you don't know what to do and everybody thinks that your lifestyle isn't correct, you're not going to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to come alongside those people and say, hey, I'm right here. I've been there. I've done this. Oh, I totally get that. That's horrible. And try to come in a human approach and then just walk with them. You can't insist that people change or, I mean, that doesn't work. If you've ever raised teenagers, you understand that. And so you just have to walk alongside and then one day they'll call and you have to be there to answer the phone.
Because that's when they're saying, I want help.
Or something. Yes. Right. You know what? This is ridiculous. You're right. I should be doing something different. I met two women that lived in an RV and I just thought they were wonderful. And I told them how great they were. And I don't know, some things, sometimes I don't understand what I say. You know, I just say what I say. Now they're moving again. One is an interior decorator. She went to school. And the other one is in line for her fire department. So you just never, when you're stuck sometimes, you just need somebody to reach out and tell you that you're worth it and that you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be right here. Like, do you need, what do you need? What can we hook you up with somebody? Can we, you know, sometimes it just takes another person to see something in you to get you to move.
Well, and it sounds like also the person that at least knows some of the resources to connect people with, right?
Yeah. When I memorized everything when I was out there, I was like, did you know on Thursday they're giving away coats over here? And I'd hand write little flyers and hand them out.
Oh,
I was
just
so excited for people to get things. And, I'm like a cheerleader.
Yeah, that's
for
good.
People. Yeah.
And something I read, I think it was an interview with you from Facing Homelessness, that they had also kind of helped out in Rex as well. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The first time I met Rex, I didn't trust him.
Yeah.
It's funny now because he's an amazing man and he's a good friend. So, but I thought, who's this guy taking pictures of everybody?
Right.
And why is he doing this? And what nefarious thing is he trying to do? That wasn't the case at all. And I'm super, super glad that I got to meet him and super glad I got to see some of the stories. He's done so many interviews of people that aren't here anymore. And without that documentation, we wouldn't have some of that.
Mm-hmm.
He has a whole wall of pictures, and I know almost every single face on it.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, and I guess that was before, because he was located in Fremont.
Yeah. Yeah, he was right across from the Duck Walk, and he used to walk from million-dollar houses and doing architectural stuff, and then he'd have lunch with Dinkus or some of the other guys that were down there, and, you know, they'd have a 12 ounces of their favorite beverage or 24 ounces of their favorite beverage. And then he would sit there and, and that was such a natural, beautiful way to make things, to create, you know, that he just let things happen naturally. And that's a lot of what we need to do with what's going on now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now they have the window of kindness and the, I guess, yes, in my backyard or whatever, something. I forgot what the actual term is, but where people can live in tiny houses and
The block project.
Block projects.
So
yeah.
it's such a great thing. And I know a couple people that live in the block houses too. And what a great thing to put a tiny house in the middle of a block where the whole neighborhood knows and can jump in and join and help with the garden and get to know that person and make this sense of community so that they can grow and become a beautiful part of society. Because the things that I learned while I was out there, they don't teach in college. There is no course.
Right.
There, it's on the spot, fly, duct tape, super glue kind of stuff. I mean, it's middle of the night, run out of gas, and five homeless people pushing you across the street. You wouldn't believe the sense of community. I wish there was a way to emerge people into that so that they could see the beauty. You know, going to soup kitchens and doing things like that, that's a great way to get to know. But I wish there was a way that I could just take somebody and immerse them in that so that they could understand that it's not one thing. It's so many. It's so complex that everybody's story is completely different than the next. I became homeless because I had a stalker and I told him no. And so if it can be that easy, then it can happen to anyone. It's not just the paycheck thing. It can be a wrong turn. I mean, it can be really devastating. And then if you don't have any kind of safety net or family, or if you already come from a, you know, generational traumas, then nobody knows what to do. And then you get this shame and blame, and then we're blaming the victim.
Right. And then people like the heroes for the homeless, the hugs and the hard-boiled eggs can be something just really concrete and helpful.
Yeah. I mean, you don't think that a stranger tapping on your window is going to affect you, but like in my case, I come from a large family, but I didn't want them to know.
Yeah.
I went to college. I used to own a house. I ran people's businesses. This is embarrassing. There's so much shame wrapped around homelessness. So much.
So you didn't let your family know, right?
They found out and were angry at me. But I got out. I wanted to get out before I told them. Because I've been in all kinds of other problems. You know, I've fixed myself. I've had surgeries. You know, like, I always get out of things. So this is just one more thing I'm going to get out of. It's okay.
Right.
But we really do need to tell people. But it's hard because it is. There's so much shame.
Right. Yeah, but that, I love what you say. I mean, the sense of community and the strengths that people bring to it. I mean, just what people have to do to not just survive, but also thrive during homelessness is immense. Yeah.
Soup kitchens were, I could eat anywhere every single day during that time. It's different now. And then there was the Bridge Care Center. They were of huge impact in me. They just were bringing clothes to this little corner on Market and 15th and at the Safeway, like at the bus stop. There's like a little shelter thing. And they would just drag these bins of clothes from the church up to this corner, like I think it was twice a month. And I never remembered, but the days I did remember that they were there, I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. And they had socks and hygiene and coats and blankets and that was one of the places I made the little flyer for and was like, oh, do you know about this place? Like, they're only here a couple times a month, but you really got to go there because you can get a full set of clothes and, you know, they should really be in a building. And then they decided, they partnered with a fisheries company and they got this place for, I don't know, free or super cheap. I think we fixed the roof while we were there and a couple other things. And as soon as they went into a building, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to volunteer there. I don't even think I asked. I think I just showed,
just
up,
showed up
and just started volunteering. And then when I got hit by the car, so then I was gone for a while. But they let me keep my van there and watch things and stuff. I'm getting lost in this. When I got out, I said, I had this dream while I was in the nursing home. I had this dream that we could do more, that we could create this program where we could pick people up off the street and we could just give them like a little internship. We could keep them where they are, but we could give them this little internship. And so now they're in this building where they hand out clothes and hygiene, and maybe they're filling the hygiene kits, maybe they're restocking the clothes. And so we made this program called the ARC. Advocate representing the community. And I was the first person. And then one of my close friends was the second person, and I think we're 8 people into it now. They've all been housed. They get a little stipend for the 6 month. They get all these mentors through the bridge, and the bridge is connected to Quest Church, so there's lots of mentors. They are through the 6 month. They figure out one thing they want to do for the community. One person figured out a better access to water for people and got a fountain and put in somewhere. And then someone else. What did she do? Helped with the meal program and did like a list of meals that we could hand out and kept it updated. So that was one thing. And they just all, each ARC participant did something for the community in different ways. And it just pulled out one person. And then when you have somebody that's in that role, then the rest of the community sees it and they have something to strive for. So then we had a line of people wanting to do this role.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's still going on?
It's still going on.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So tell me, we were chatting a little bit before the interview about your MS. When did you, like, what kind of symptoms and when? And I know you said that it was frustrating to get a diagnosis.
So I was diagnosed with MS in 1996. I didn't at that time have any activity in my brain or anything like that. And I had optic neuritis. I went blind in my left eye in an hour. It took me 3 days before they figured out the specialist. This is hard for me to talk about. So,
okay, sorry.
No, it's okay. It needs to be said. So it was really hard for me to 3 days of not knowing, like, why did I lose the sight in my eye and what the heck? And it's called optic neuritis, and my body. MS sometimes thinks that there's a disease inside of you and it'll attack things. And so that's what it did. My own body attacked my left eye. And I have peripheral. I don't have the center of my eye vision. So I can still see things like that flash up or come off to my left side. But technically, I'm blind in my left eye.
And it sounds like it took a little while to get to the specialist.
It took forever to get to the specialist.
And,
But then once we figured out it was fine, that doctor became a researcher, Dr. Craig Smith, and he's done amazing things on the research end of MS, and they've found out a lot of things. And I've worked with people at Bastyr too, and so I found out a lot about some supplements that I should be taking. And so I've really, I mean, this last 10 years, I've done a lot for my health, a lot. But while I was homeless, I was having some symptoms, and I have 5 lesions in my body from MS. I have 4 in my brain, and I have 1 in my neck. And those all showed up pretty much while I was homeless. Because of the stress. I went in to go talk to the doctors. I went into the emergency room. I was having problems. I was really having a hard time walking and stuff while I was homeless. That was hence the bike. I was having a hard time, and I went into the hospital, and they told me flat out I didn't have MS, that there were no records of me having MS, and they didn't know what I was talking about, and most people that were homeless had MS. And I was really taken back by that because I thought my mother was a nurse, and I grew up in the healthcare system, and I had such a different view of it that I had never had that kind of an experience and was really horrified and told my story throughout the street and started hearing a lot of other stories on the street about the inadequacy of homelessness and healthcare. Would love to change that. Would love to have MSW students and stuff riding around in my car so that people know.
Like you did have this morning.
So now we have an MSW student. And then I'm linked to a class once a year for seniors at the UW, and we do a problem solving about organizations, or like nonprofits. So I am digging my way into the UW, whether they like it or not. I would love to have a class that would emerge people into this so that we have a better understanding what we're doing to humans and the psyche and and how this can help later and empower our students to be able to help the clients in a way that's realistic. I mean, not everything is textbook.
Right. And you can't, as you were saying before, you can't demand people that they fix something right away.
No, learning it never works.
Patience.
You have to... You can suggest things, but leading by example is one of the best ways. That's why lived experience people out there helping and being outreach workers and case managers are really important. Mm-hmm. It's really important to have an understanding. I mean, that's how Bill and Bill did it, right, with AA. Like it was alcoholics walking with alcoholics. I'm not actually super excited about that model, but I do like the premise that they had that hey, buddy, I've been through this. Let's talk.
Right.
And that, if you just say hello, which is one of Rex's favorite phrases, but it works. Most people don't say hello to homeless people. Mm-hmm. They walk up and hand them a pair of socks. They don't ask if they need them. I didn't need socks most of the time. I lived in my van. I knew where the laundromat was. I had a job the entire time. Mm-hmm. I was homeless.
What were you doing?
So I was landscaping because I didn't have to take a shower all the time.
Oh, there you go.
So you do what you have to do in the environment that you're given.
Mm-hmm.
I never gave up. I never once. I mean, I was probably the happiest homeless person there was.
I mean, you're helping other people too.
Right. Yeah, that helped too with my psyche, I'm sure. Yeah. But it's really important to listen more than you hear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or listen more than you speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's you're going to hear something that might click for that person later if you can reiterate it back to them. Like, oh, don't you remember you said this? Oh yeah, you know, I really do want to do that. I've wanted to, but I just don't know how. Well, let's find a way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find a way to get there. You know, sometimes the reason somebody's stuck on the side of the road is a fuel pump. That's it. But it's so overwhelming to that person that it's not the fuel pump anymore. It's that dinner table conversation with the parents that you keep replaying over in your head. It's that time you skipped class and now you don't have a degree. It is that time that you skipped out on something and you didn't make it. It's that visit you missed and that person died. You're stuck in that trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do. But when you walk up, they will regurgitate everything in their world when they realize that you are listening.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll get to that fuel pump.
Yeah.
Because it's just been pent up.
Mm-hmm.
No one's been there to listen. And everybody else is in the same situation at the dinner you're going to eat at or, you know, it's hard.
Right. So tell me, I know you're working with the Scofflaw Mitigation Team?
So we were called the Scofflaw Mitigation Team, but that language can be a little harsh with homeless people. Scofflaw, what does that mean?
Well, I don't even know.
Scofflaw came out in 2011. It was the city's idea. It was when they decided that everybody in the city had to move every 72 hours. Mm. Whether you own your car or own your house or not, if it's on a city street, you have to move every 72 hours. Well, then my predecessor, Jean Darcy, passed away. She said... her and a few others, and Bill and Elizabeth Maupin, and Bill Curlin Hacklett, decided, well, that's ridiculous. There are people who live in vehicles, and sometimes they can't move their car, or it's expensive. You can't move every 72 hours. And so we said, hey, why don't we work with parking enforcement? Why don't you call us before you go out and give somebody a ticket? Mm-hmm. Why don't we go talk to them and see if we can get them to move and see what the problem is? And so, and Graham Press was involved in it that time. I think I heard about them the first time in 2011 because Graham was living on the street doing his papers.
Research, yeah.
Yeah, his research. Yeah. That was just a trying time, and we still have it going on.
So. Or they tow. And even though, I don't know if you knew, did you know Stephen? Is it Stephen Long?
Yeah, I didn't know him personally, but I mean, we're better where we are now because now we at least have people are living in their vehicles and we're giving judges the option to, well, they live in their vehicle, let's waive some fees, let's try to get it out of the tow yard. But we can't make the tow company pay for all those kind of mistakes.
Right.
I mean, so we need to get better at identifying people and we need places. We need city parking lots. And, you know, for 6 months we've had a major player in the city that's had a 1.9 RFP on a parking lot, and they haven't opened it yet. And everybody's like in an uproar. Well, what's the city doing? What's the county doing? What are they doing? Why haven't they opened it yet? Do you know any open land for free?
No.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Is that, I'm sorry, this country is all about money.
Well, and owning land.
Yes.
And houses, yeah.
And so it's hard to find land, and they want a lot of money for it. It's $300,000 a month for this or $120,000 a month for this. I mean, you got to put 20 RVs or 10 RVs on something. You need power and water.
And that, space, yeah.
That ups it even more. And you'd like something that's cleared already. Well, what if you get just a lot that's all full of bushes? Well, that's great, right? That's probably cheaper. But then there's a lot of prep to get that ready to go. So it's not an easy process.
Right. Well, then tell me about, I guess, on the other part of it. I mean, I know it's small, and you know, because Seattle doesn't have a lot of safe lots. But can you tell me about like your work now with U Heights?
So we do have a safe lot. We have a couple safe lots. I think we have three actually. We do have a safe lot in the University District at U Heights. We have managed to fill that space three times and go through it last year. Most of those people are somewhere else, housed or working or where they want to be. And so that's been a success, but that takes intention. Every Friday, we meet, and then I do work on Tuesdays too. So you have to just pick up with the client, unpack what's going on, and then just move forward through each little thing. And we've been able to do that within a few months and get people up and going. One person just wanted to be nomadic and didn't have the information on how to do that. And through what Grand Press has been doing, I'm connected to a lot of nationwide places, and I was able to connect him with some places so that he could go live on BLM land. But he had no idea. He was just stuck in the city. He lost his house. He had no idea about what was going on out there. A little bit older, so not as techno savvy as some of them, but just had no idea.
And so just of where he could
yeah,
go.
Yeah, and just giving him the information. I mean, he just lit up like a Christmas tree.
Wow.
He was just like, oh, I had no idea. I could stay there for 6 months. I just need a permit. Oh, wow. He was really in nature.
That's a huge thing.
Yeah,
for
because
all
we,
of us.
There's several studies that if we're, you know, that we need trees and nature and like
water.
I spoke about water earlier, you know, we need that. If we don't, it doesn't center us.
That's right.
And, you know, when you're stuck in your car and that's the only place you have to store things, all of a sudden it looks like you're a hoarder because you have your grandmother's album and you have your dog's ashes and you have everything that you owned in there. I did a talk with Rex once about a backpack and I talked about how much stuff was in a backpack, but it's the same thing. You're hauling around your kitchen sink and it's the same way in the car. You have to make that your home. And, you know, anybody who has access to YouTube can go on a tiny house hunt any day of the week. But you can also look for tiny car living. And some of those tiny house places will show you people that live in tiny vans that they've converted them mm-hmm. to amazing little vehicles. That's where it's going in this country because no one can afford housing. I mean, the cheapest house in my neighborhood goes for $599,000.
Where do you live?
I live on Lake Forest Park over on the other side of Lake City.
Yeah, the housing in Seattle is crazy for everybody. So in the the U Heights Safe Lots program, as I understand, it's up to 10 vehicles and it's just cars and trucks.
It can be excuse me. It can be passenger vans and cars. And it's it can be single people. Families, I try to shift to Mary's Place so mm-hmm. they can get into housing quicker.
Right. And schools and stuff like that.
Yeah, because they need to get those kids bussed off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have bus programs that no matter where the kid is, they can go to the same school.
Yeah, it's excellent.
So it's just we've done a lot with families. Mm-hmm. But we need to – we have a lot of single men and a lot of single women out mm-hmm. there in their vehicles. And we need a few more services mm-hmm. for that. Not everybody's addicted to drugs, even though that's the consensus.
That's right. That's what everybody thinks.
Yeah. But right. That's not true. And is it the drugs? Or was it the depression from homelessness and the easy access to drugs? Because once you're homeless, the dealers are standing right there.
Right.
So this will take the pain away.
Mm-hmm. And the hunger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a dicey thing. I mean, you cannot put a blanket statement on this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just ridiculous to do that. That's 1800s thinking. We can't do that. We need to pull everybody out one at a time with intention. But those lots save lives because, you know, I've had single women that are so scared to be on the side street that don't know anything about anything. Mm-hmm. They don't even know anything about services. So once we get them into the lot, we start to open up their world. We show them all the different services in the area. We show them different pathways they could take. And then pretty soon they're like, okay, I'm going to have to think about this. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about this next week? Mm-hmm. Yes, we can. Mm-hmm. And then I just flood them with as much information as I can, you know, slowly so that it isn't overflowing.
Right.
But there's just enough so we can absorb it and then we can figure out, you know, go take a view of it, go walk through. Is this a place where we want to move to? Is this something that we want to do? Lake City Partners have come up with some really good answers to that. They have a place called The Oaks, and it's a nursing home setting where they have individual rooms and then they have individual case managers and they do just a wonderful job. We partner with them a lot. We had, I can't say names, but we did have a lady that had some health problems mm-hmm. and that was a really great place for her to go. They could refrigerate her medications. Mm-hmm. She could cook on her own. It was just they adapted for her. Mm-hmm. And that was really good that they made those spaces for her to grow.
And she's doing pretty well.
She's doing really well.
That's good.
Yeah. And she's not living in her car anymore. Yeah. She has a bed that she can lay down in. And a case manager where they're making progress and they're moving forward. So and that's what we need. We need those spaces where, like nursing homes for older, we mm-hmm. need that for people that are in transition as well.
Right.
I don't like to call people broken because if they were broken, you'd be able to see it, right? it's a lot of it is human causes. We've done this to ourselves. We've done this to our children and generational, like I spoke about earlier. I have some people that are five generations out here. Five generations homeless. Mm-hmm. We should be ashamed of that. That's what we should be ashamed mm-hmm. of. We should be ashamed of walking by somebody and not looking at them or shrugging and going, oh. I mean, that's just so damaging to people. It's not necessary. Just look at them and smile. Make them feel better, You know, that it's not that hard. It's so easy for us to save dogs.
Yes. Yes. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah.
It is really, we need to put more intention in saving humans. Instead of blaming them, we need to, because we wouldn't do that with rape victims. We've learned to get away from that kind of talk. We've learned to speak better around that subject.
Right. Most people.
Most people. True story. That is true.
Yeah.
But we should get better at our talk mm-hmm. with homelessness because it is damaging.
Right. So I have one probably like because I know you're super busy. So I don't want to take too much of your time, but one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because you have the lived experience and you're doing this work now, and you talked about the importance of people with lived experience. And in England, they call it experts by experience, which I think is great. But one of the things that I have thought about and seem to have been exacerbated by the pandemic, the stress for everybody, right, is the extra, like the benefits of people with lived experience working in, like what they had experienced. And on the flip side of it, without the like good supports of how that can also be it can also just like be extra stressful and hurtful to people. I'm not sure if I'm so, where people with lived experience are doing this work, but then the expectations of what they're doing and not giving them the support that they need to deal with like those stressful situations. Does that make sense?
Self-care.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-care is very important. I think it's important if we're going to do lived experience that we don't live lived experience just on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be like that.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a support system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here because I went straight from homelessness to helping. Mm-hmm. That's not how that happened. There's 4 or 5 years of therapy in there. There's several mentors that guided me that have gone to college for this and done all this that kept me within the boundaries that I need to be able to do this work in a healthy way so it doesn't affect my MS, so it doesn't affect me, and that I am the best person I can be when I go out there to help the people. Because if I don't, then things can come out of pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants that. So I think it's really important if we were as a giant society going to do this like on a big scale, I would link lived experience people with MSW students and make sure that they're talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want that as teams going out. That's what I would want. And those kind of experience, because then you have a clinical version and a lived experience version.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a really good team that could bounce off of each other in ways that you've never seen before. And the lived experience person brings that, I know where you are right now because I've been there. And that can coax that person out to communicate to other people. And you can do this warm handoff to a clinical psychologist or a reach case manager or a lead case manager or with Catholic Community Services or Solid Ground. There's so many service providers out there. When I said earlier that, no one was out there, it's because I couldn't see them because there isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And because all of those case managers are so overloaded.
Yeah.
There isn't one case manager in this metropolitan area that would tell you, I have 30 clients and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
They all have hundreds because we can't just walk by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many out there. I just pick my day every day. I have so much to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just there isn't a calendar big enough to hold all this. It just we need to be more intent on solving it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that homelessness makes us a lot of money, too.
Yes, the homelessness industrial complex.
Yep. I call it an industry because I've worked in several different industries, and this one's pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of money here, but it's not being appropriated right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not going to go into specifics because
right,
we'd be here all
day. You don't need to. Some of them.
But, and it's different and varying, and there's great things, and we need more money, but it, you know, mm-hmm. it's so complex. It's just as complex as saying that one guy on the street, he's out here for this reason, because you'll never be able to figure it out. It'll take you. I never really know somebody until about the sixth time I've seen them. And the first time I see them, they show me what I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, I might see some trauma. Third time, probably I will. Fourth or fifth, that's when I start to hear the things.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I, so it's not just going out there one time. It's revisiting and revisiting and revisiting and revisiting.
And building a relationship.
Yeah, and building a relationship and trust.
Mm.
It's really hard to trust when you think that you're all alone.
Mm-hmm.
We're taught to be individuals in this country. So I don't know why this surprises everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're taught to be individuals. And when we fall, then we're taught that, oh, well, we did something wrong. We better fix it before we come home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's on the street right now, is waiting people waiting to go home, but not knowing how to fix that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So anything that I haven't asked you that you'd want to include in this?
I mean, we could be here all day. I just think it's really important that we support the agencies that are already working and stop attacking them, because they are doing good work.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see it. I think it's really important that we step out of some of those boxes and stop looking down at the ground when we walk by people, that we just smile and nod. I mean, if everybody smiled at me while I was homeless, I wouldn't have been homeless that long.
Wow. That will take a little bit to sink in for me, but that's really powerful. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate your time and yourself and your work and everything else. But yeah, thanks. It's been really great to talk to you, Jen.
If you thought of more questions, I would come back and do this again.
All right. Okay. I might take you up on that offer.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
So that's a wrap, Daniel.